going to do is turn on the recording, and you have to approve that at your end. And the last thing we're going to do is share screen. Okay. All right. That should have worked. I hope everybody is seeing my screen. Yes? Okay, thumbs up if you're seeing text on the screen. Good. All right. Okay, we spent the first half of the first beginning couple of shiurim on this parak Yud Gimel, dealing with the story of Amnon Tamar. I'm not going to replay it, as that's an intense story. I'm going to reference it a few times. If you are just joining us tonight and you're not familiar with it, you can do a quick read of the first 22 psukim of Perek Yud Gimel, and we're picking up from Pasuk Chaf Gimel. So actually, maybe even a pasuk or two before. So the end of the story of Amnon and Tamar, V'lo diber Avshalom im Amnon l'miravi ad tov, ki senei Avshalom et Amnon al dvar she'ina et Tamar achoto. Avshalom kind of cuts off any communication from Avshalom. The hatred is searing, and he kind of, to his credit, he doesn't express open on animosity, although less to his credit, he's kind of plotting the next 2 years, his revenge, but nonetheless, that is the context, and that's where we're picking up from here. Pasuk of Gimel. Vayi lishnatayim yamim, vayu gozizim laAvshalom beval chatzor asherim Ephraim. So now it's kind of a shift of scenes. We're 2 years later. 2 years later, just in that kind of imagine in our minds what's been going on for the last 2 years. Going on, not a lot. Avshalom has been silent to Amnon, and David is deep in his aftermath of Bathsheba and dealing with the death of the child and perhaps the death of other children that we talked about in the context of the Shlomo being the fifth child born, not the second. And Shlomo hasn't been born yet. Based on our calculation, Shlomo won't be born until after the battle with Avshalom. And so David is kind of immobilized in terms of his ability to act and to function. And so we saw earlier, Vamelach David Shemat, Kol Adonim Eileh Vayichal Ma'od, David heard Amnon's rape of Tamar, but he does nothing about it, right? He gets very angry, and then there's silence. Silence from David because of inaction, silence from Avshalom because of his own internal calculations. And 2 years later, they're having a kind of a sheep shearing celebration in Baal Chatzor. Try that three times fast, I challenge you. A sheep shearing celebration in Baal Chatzor. Where is Baal Chatzor? I'm going to do a quick map shift, so stay with me. This is I've shared this website with you before. This is a website, atanach.com or .org. It's published by Herzog, and it's a biblical map by Perek and Sefer. You can pull up any Perek and Tanakh, superimposed on a Google map engine. So you can kind of go anywhere in Tanakh, and literally anywhere in Tanakh, and then pull up the Google engine. So for example, here's Yerushalayim, here's Baal Chatzor, and if that's not enough context to tell us where that is, we can do a couple of things. First of all, we can go to satellite view, and then we can pull up a local contemporary map. So this is today's map, and that is Baal Chatzor biblical map. And if we zero in a little bit, you can kind of get a sense. Here is the Highway 60, here is Ofra, and there is our Baal Chatzor. And if we kind of zoom out a little bit, you get a sense of where we are in the country. Here's Yerushalayim, here's Tel Aviv. North of Ramallah, north of some, just south of Shiloh, a little bit northeast of Ofra, is the area known as Baal Chatzor. Why it's significant for us is not really a major piece, other than the fact that it's sort of Avshalom's home territory. It's outside of the palace. It is Avshalom's arena. He's got his flock and the shearing of the sheep celebration is taking place here in Baal Chatzor. This is all a grazing land. You can sort of see the change in the sort of the dramatic change in the climate of the region as you go down into the hill, and this is where he's got his flock, and this is where his people, his servants, those who are loyal to him, and so this is taking place in Baal Chatzor. Why 2 years? I'm assuming we know what happens in the end of the story, right? Because we've read it through in the very first week. So I'm assuming we all know that eventually Avshalom ambushes Amnon and has him killed there. So we kind of have to know the end, the result of what's going on. But why wait 2 years? I'm assuming that this celebration in Baal Chatzor is an annual event, at least. It's not a biannual event. And so it's not just a matter of the circumstances of waiting till the next celebration of the event, but in fact, he's calculated this. He's waited this out for 2 years until he can bring everybody together. We know from other instances, for example, and this I put on the source page, the Radak immediately links us to minhagam ahem la'asot mishte biyom shehayu gozuzim tzonam v'chein b'inyan naval. And it was their minhag to have a big celebration whenever they would do this shearing of the sheep. And this is exactly what we find in the story of Naval. Now, the story of Naval is Shmuel Aleph Perek Chaf Hei. It's been a long time since we were in Shmuel Aleph Perek Chaf Hei. But if you remember that moment where David's army comes to Naval, and with the expectation down in the south, the expectation that they would get paid for their service of protecting the local Yishuvim from raiders and marauders. And he has an encounter with Naval that's not pleasant. That's where he meets Avigail. But there, the first time they come, Sha'alat Narachav Yagidulach, Vimtsua Narim Chen Be'necha Ki Al Yom Tov Banu. They come to this event as a Yom Tov. It's a Yom Tov. It's a major celebration. And this seems to have been an annual occurrence, seasonal, as once a year. So from that perspective, the question becomes, why is he waiting 2 years? I think it's not a hard question to answer. Why is he waiting 2 years? Yosef waited 2 years in jail because he was waiting. That's the other phrase. Ve'ilu shnatayim yamim is in the beginning of Parshat Miketz. Miketz shnatayim yamim. When Yosef was stuck in jail for 2 extra years waiting for Paro to have his dream. Here, Avshalom is waiting for 2 years, but I don't think he's waiting because for a dream. I think he's waiting for what purpose? Somebody chime in. For what purpose?
Is he waiting for his chance?
He might be waiting for his chance, but the question is, why didn't he take it a year ago, right? The last time that there was this kind of celebration. Clearly, they're going to Baal Chatzor because this is outside of the palace. So it's outside of the influence of David, where Avshalom has his loyal servants and he can control the shots. That's a given. But I'm assuming if it's an annual event, why does he have to wait 2 years? Why didn't he go right away?
Maybe something happened the last time where, like, his sister couldn't come, or
maybe we just
and then he talked about it with his henchmen.
Possibly we just don't have the evidence to that.
Maybe he wanted Amnon to get comfortable that he got away with this.
Yeah,
right. I think that's the core of the issue, is that if you give it enough time, everybody forgets. Time has a way of healing in some instances and covering up in others. In other words, if you let it go as if everybody kind of goes about their business. So after 2 years, it's almost a routine. Nobody's talking about this anymore. Not even in the palace, not even in the world of David. They're just you know, David forgets about it. Avshalom, well, we'll talk about Avshalom. Sorry, Amnon. We'll talk about Amnon in a little bit. But even Tamar was told to be silent, not to say anything. And so for 2 years, everything kind of goes back to a routine. Back to a routine, back to a shigra. And 2 years, nobody's suspicious or less suspicious. There's one person in the story who's still very suspicious. We'll come back to him at the end of the day, at the end of the shiur today. But for now, everybody lets their guard down. 2 years later, Avshalom has this big celebration in Baal Chatzor, in Har Ephraim, north of the palace, in his territory, Vayikra Avshalom L'chol Bnei Melech, and to this great celebration, he invites all of the royal family, the kids, the children of the king. So how does that play out? So that's what we're going to look at next. I'm going to jump on my pages. Vayomer, hineina gozezim la'avdecha, yelech na'amelech v'avadav im avdecha. So Shalom comes to David and he says, we're having a big celebration. And it's a big event. We would be honored if the king would join us. It would be our honor. The king and his servants would join us. No, my son, says David. If we all go, the king and his entourage and his secret service and his servants and his cars and his caravans, it's too many people. You go. We don't want to be a burden to you. He begged him, he pressed him, he pushed him. Vayifrotzbo is the same word. But David didn't want to go. Blessed him, he said, you go, my son. Go, have fun, enjoy. Do what you need to do. I'm staying out of this one. I'll stay in the palace. Vayomer Avshalom, v'lo yelech na'itanu Amnon achi. So Avshalom says, okay, if the king is not going to come, then at least send Amnon, my brother. Why is the logical choice, if David doesn't go, why is the logical choice Amnon?
Because he's the elder.
Right, because he's the Bechor. He's the Bechor, and from all intents and purposes, therefore, he is the heir to the throne. He's the crown prince. Why should Amnon go with you? Avshalom pushed. So finally, David conceded and he sent Amnon and all of the king's sons to go with him. All right. I do not like this translation. He let Amnon go is not the same as he sent. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Vayishlach is not vayishaleach. We'll talk about that momentarily. But I want to go back for a second. When Avshalom comes to David, does everybody know the rest of the parak? We read it through once before. Does everybody know the events of what happens next in the story? Because I can make a lot of assumptions on what's going on based on what's going on. Let me just to put everybody on the same page, I'm just going to read a couple of psukim further and then we'll come back. So they get to Baal Chatzor, Vayitzav Avshalom et Na'arav Lemor. Shalom commands his servants, meaning his loyal guard, his loyal servants. He says to them, "Ru'una ketov lev Amnon bayayin." Take heed when you see Amnon getting a little bit too much wine. All bad things happen when you start with alcohol. That's my plug for the night. Ve'amarti alechem, I will tell you, I will instruct you. Haku et Amnon. That's when you're going to kill Amnon. Smite him, kill him. And then in response to the look on their faces of horror, you're talking about the crown prince, So Amnon, Avshalom continues and he says, Al tirau, don't be afraid. Halo anochi tziviti etchem. This is me commanding you. I'm commanding you. This isn't coming from the king. This isn't coming from anywhere else. I'm telling you, you are loyal to me. Chizku, v'yu livnechayo, be courageous, be warriors, be valiant. This is my instruction. And that's exactly what happens. The servants of Avshalom did exactly as Amnon told him to do, and that means told them to do, which means that he killed Amnon. What that means in a second. And all the king's children, they got up, they saddled their mules, and they fled. Okay, the rest of it we'll talk about in a few minutes. But let's go back to Avshalom's request from David. Let the king and his servants come and join us in Baal Chatzor. Knowing that Avshalom's intention is to kill Amnon, you have to ask the question, why invite David? What would have happened if David would have said yes?
Yeah, but it's protocol. You have to invite him.
Say yes.
I agree it's protocol, but protocol is not to kill your brother and to kill the crown prince also. I'm not sure that he's too worried about protocol.
I think he knew he was going to say no.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's the Barbanel. The Barbanel says exactly that. Barbanel says he knew that he was going to say no. Says the Barbanel in source, giving you source 3, Avshalom requested David to go. Avshalom did not want David to come with. Kiim lahasir safek milibo kedei sheyiftach hamelech b'tuv kavanato. His intention was to mislead. His intention was to misdirect. His intention was to ask David to come. David for sure wasn't going to come. And once he's sort of played the role of the, as you said, his protocol, he's played the role of asking the king to come. Now he's kind of avoided the suspicion of why he's invited Avshalom to this faraway remote palace that belongs to Avshalom. Why is he invited Amnon? Yeah. He's invited everybody. He's invited Kobane Amelech. He's invited the king. Avshalom happens to have been instead of the king because the king can't go. So the crown prince plays that role, and then it makes a lot of sense. The question is, how was he sure that David would say no? What would have happened if David would say yes?
Wouldn't he have killed David?
Another year.
He may wait another year. Yeah, maybe. I think it's a foregone conclusion that David would have said no. Based on what?
He was depressed. He was...
Based on a pattern of behavior that we've seen since the story of Bathsheba, which is that David is doing nothing. Right? David has essentially secluded himself into the palace. The Sanhedrin has abandoned him. He's dealing with the family crisis of Bathsheba and her children and the crisis that one after the other that brings. He's taken no action. He didn't take any action against Amnon when he should have. He hasn't taken any action against anybody else. Avshalom's rebellion will start from the vantage point of nobody's getting justice around here because the king is not running the courts as he should. And so I think it's a foregone conclusion and a fairly logical one that David is not going to come. On the other hand, let's just play it out for a second. What would have happened if David would have said yes? Just in theory. What would have happened if David would have said yes?
He would have killed him.
Oh, that's a big assertion. That's a big assumption, but I think you're correct. I think, one of two things would have happened. What for sure would have happened is that Avshalom's rebellion against David and against the kingdom would have started 3 years early. In other words, had David walked into Avshalom's trap, Avshalom, who sees himself as the only one taking the law into his hands, the only one doing anything, the only one leading in this kingdom, the only one with a moral backbone left in this kingdom, Avshalom, who has every intention of eventually taking the throne, Shalom would have had the perfect opportunity to either kill David, if his servants would have gone along with killing the king, or even if he hadn't killed the king, if you remember, his primary issue is to demonstrate that somebody has to bring justice to this case. Somebody has to hold Amnon accountable. And if David's not going to do it, then Avshalom will. And if Avshalom does it in David's presence, in plain sight, David's sitting there and saying and doing nothing, but Avshalom takes the matter into his hands, and on behalf of his sister, and on behalf of justice in the kingdom, and on behalf of every oppressed and abused woman in the kingdom, kills Amnon to implement the justice and to have justice served, I'm assuming that that would have been the beginning of Avshalom's rebellion. Would not have been far afield. So either he would have killed David, or he would have done it anyway, and David would have been at that point forward inconsequential. David refuses, and let's go back. David refuses, and Albany, I suspect he refuses more out of the same pattern of inaction all along, but that pattern in this particular case has probably saved his life, certainly saved his kingdom. And so he turns and he says, okay, well, if you're not going to come, then at least send Yelech Naitanu Amnon Achi. Send Amnon, my brother. That is a very ironic description. Why?
Because there's no love lost.
He hasn't spoken to his brother in 2 years.
I haven't spoken to each other in 2 years. I can call Amnon many things. I think Avshalom calling Amnon his brother is pretty ironic. Right? And he's about to kill him. He's about to commit fratricide and regicide. Is that what you when you kill their brother who's the crown prince? You commit them both at the same time, right? But at the same time, what message is he conveying when he says to David, Yelech na itanu Amnon achi? Right. It's conveying a message of, again, it's all part of that deflection. It's all part of that.
He's showing affection.
Yeah, affection, brotherly relationship. Yeah, nothing nefarious in his intention. The king can't come, so at least the crown prince should come. Yelech na Amnon achi. So finally, David says, "Fine, Yelech na." He begs him, and he says, "Finally, Vayishlachito et Amnon vet kol bnei melech." It's a powerful moment. I'll just point out two things. One is that when you talk about this request, Avshalom says, Yelech na itanu Amnon achi. Think about the players for a second. You have Avshalom making a request from David to send Amnon, his brother, to him. On the face of it, for intentions that are familial and love and brotherly and peaceful, and with malice in his heart to do him harm. Flip that around.
Sounds familiar.
Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, it sounds like what Amnon did about his sister.
Exactly right. Go back to Pasuk. Go back to the beginning of the parashah.
That sounded like what David did.
That's exactly right. Meishlach, when Amnon is feigning this illness and desiring his sister to come to him, he says to the king, Vayomer Amnon al-Melech, Tavona tama achoti utlabev leinai shtei libivot v'ram yada. Amnon requesting of David to send Tamar ostensibly on a mission of peaceful, loving familial connection, but with malice in his heart, which eventually turns nefarious.
Was that similar to David doing that with Bathsheba's husband?
Oh, we're going to come back to Bathsheba's husband in a second. That's exactly where the analogy goes. Vayishlach David el Tamar habayta. And in fact, David sends Tamar to that to Amnon's grasp. Unintentionally, even unwillingly, unwittingly, he doesn't realize what's happening, but David has sent Tamar into the clutches of Amnon, her brother. Well, jump to from Pasuk Zayin to Pasuk Chav Zayin. Vayishlach ito et Amnon bet kol b'nei melech. David sends Amnon and all of the king's sons to Avshalom's palace and into Avshalom's clutches. Which is why I don't like this translation, because vayishlach is different than l'shaleach. L'shaleach is to send. L'shaleach is to let go. It's a subtle difference in the binyanim of Tanakh, but nonetheless, Vayishlach is he sent him. And he sends Amnon into Avshalom's clutches the same way he had sent Tamar into the hands of Amnon 20 psukim earlier. Ironically, there's even a broader context here, which is that if you go back to the story of David and Bathsheba, trying to avoid rehashing a year's worth of material, so I'm kind of avoiding going into that parak. But if once in a while we have no choice. But if you go back to the story of David and Bathsheba, one of the pieces of the story that we didn't go into in detail, but is there, is the fact that in that sequence of events, David is playing the role of sitting in the palace and directing everybody to their fates. And the key word in that whole parak is the word vayishlach. And I'll show it to you. I'll just go back to the source page for a second. I pulled it up here. So this is more or less a summary from Parak Yud Aleph of every place where David sends somebody. So it starts in the beginning. Vayihi tshuvat Hashem le'et tzeit ha'malachim, a year after the wars begin. Vayishlach David et Yoav et Avadav imo et kol Yisrael vayashchitu et bnei Amon vayatzilu al Rabbah v'David yoshev b'Yerushalayim. It starts when David sends Yoav to battle in Amon, and he stays behind in Yerushalayim to direct things from a distance. Then he sees Bathsheba. Vayishlach David vayidrosh li'isha, and he sent his messengers to find out who this girl is, and finds out that she is Bathsheba bat Eliyah, wife of Uriah Hiti. The rest of that story we talked about. Vayishlach David malachim, David sends messengers. Vayikached to bring Bathsheba to the palace. This was a fateful mistake, because you can't really keep things very secret when you send messengers to bring her to the palace. It's a very difficult way to keep a secret. Nonetheless, that's what he does. And she comes to him, Bathsheba. And once she becomes pregnant, and once David realizes that the game is afoot, so to speak, Vayishlach David el Yoav, shlach elai et Uriah achiti. He sends a message to the front saying to Yoav, send me Uriah achiti. Vayishlach Yoav et Uriah David. So Uriah does. He sends Yoav to David. But Yomer David al Uriah, and then after it's all that whole conversation between Pasuk Vav and Pasuk Yibet about going home to Bathsheba, etc. David and Uriah refuses, and Uriah explodes in a fit of insubordination, and that borders on treason when he describes Yoav as his master instead of David. But Yomer David al Uriah, shepaze gamayom umacha eshalcheka. Stay here for now. Tomorrow I will send you back to the front. And comes the next day. David sefer el Yoav vayishlach biyad Uriah. David writes the fateful book or letter in which he seals Uriah's fate, and he sends it to Uriah. And then at the end of the day, after Uriah's death, after Bathsheba finishes the mourning period for Uriah, Vayavo ha'evel, vayishlach David v'yasfal beto, he sends for Bathsheba. So the whole atmosphere of the Perek, which is part of the reason why David spirals into the abyss, which is the Chet of Bathsheba, is David sitting in the palace and directing. Well, there he's directing everybody to his fate. There he is completely driving the ship, but he's driving the ship aground. As here, he is still in the driver's seat, but everybody else is driving the ship for him. And so he'll send Tamar to Amnon, but only because Amnon requested it. And he'll send Amnon to Avshalom, but only because Avshalom is cooking it all up. And so in his passiveness, though, you see the kind of throwback to the arena of Perek Yud Aleph, of David sending people to their fate. Nonetheless, that's what he does. He sends Amnon to go to Avshalom. And that raises the next question in our agenda here, which is, Avshalom has made a request of the king. He's going to a big celebration up in his palace in Baal Chatzor. Send all Bnei HaMelech and send Amnon as well. King can't come, Amnon, you come instead. If you were Amnon, what would you do? I'm going to stop.
Find an excuse. Find an excuse. But I mean, you might want to find an excuse unless Amnon forgot that he did wrong to his sister. But he probably thinks that he's like very special because he's the crown prince. So
I don't think you forget that you did these things. I don't think.
Maybe he was just feeling that. Nothing was gonna happen after time, and he was the crown. He felt like, wow, you know, right. They're inviting me.
You don't forget, but you certainly do feel somewhat protected or invulnerable or arrogant. Amnon's world, we haven't spent a lot of time talking about Amnon's worldview, but Amnon's worldview is quite frightening, right? Here's Avshalom, the last 2 years. Hasn't said a word to him. Suddenly he invites him to a secluded place in Avshalom's backyard, with Avshalom's royal guard standing at every entrance. And you have to ask yourself, after Amnon has raped and left for dead Avshalom's sister, Avshalom has not spoken to him for 2 years, and suddenly he invites him to a private secluded place where the army of is Avshalom's private army. Why would you go?
Well, he thinks he's gotten away with it. And now he thinks that Avshalom is remorse about not contacting him, and he wants to make amends. And he's
remorse is a harsh word, is a big word, maybe. Or maybe it's just he's translated all of the 2 years of silence as a kind of nothing, no part of this, kind of a negative or power of absence of a relationship. Or maybe he thinks...
It's also a party man.
But he's also possibly that he's done nothing wrong. At the end of the day, the power of self-justification is really, really extraordinary. What has, from Amnon's perspective, we encountered the potency, the power of self-justification in all of its dark side in the story of Bathsheba. In Amnon's case, right, Amnon is a mirror image of all the negative that came out of Bathsheba, of the story of Bathsheba. In Amnon's case, what has he done? He's taken a girl who you'll forgive me and forgive the crassness of the description, who's nothing more than the daughter of a Pilegesh who's not even Jewish. A Yefat Tor, the daughter of some foreign power that David captured in battle? Or he married her in some context of something or other, but he's nothing more than a Pelegish. And she's a daughter of a Pelegish, and she's not even part of the royal family, and she's an outsider. And so from Amnon's perspective, he's done nothing wrong.
And wasn't the fact still that Dovid's daughter?
Excuse me?
Isn't it Dovid's daughter, even though it was
from a Pelegish? No, so we talked about that when we first started the problem, right, of the description of her legally being able to marry Amnon, at least from Tamar's perspective, right, and suggested that she's the daughter of Ma'acha, daughter of the king of Geshur, from a different marriage, from a previous marriage before coming to Dovid. Right? That was that little...
Right, I forgot.
But even if she's a Yifator, she's not Jewish, right? She, because of that first moment, according to the Bible, whatever the circumstances are, that at least, you know, that kind of the legal piece of it we talked about, but that legal piece of it is very powerful because it's where the justification comes in Amnon's mind.
But also women didn't have a whole lot of, you know, people didn't have a whole lot of...
It depends on the person, it depends on the woman, right? It depends on the circumstances. We're talking about the moments, we're not talking about a situation to be placed on a pedestal and say, this is how... You know, this is the standard flag by which the Bible is treating women, right? This is on the contrary. The whole point of the story is
not the Bible, but Amnon and a lot of people maybe in that era.
But again, it comes back to this being who she is. She is the daughter of this Ma'acha. So I think he has the same dismissive attitude towards Avshalom. I don't think he thinks of very much of Avshalom either. Avshalom is also the son of Ma'acha. He's the crown prince. He's the firstborn. He's the warrior. He's invincible. Avshalom is inviting me to the local sheep shearing event. It's a big yontif. It's a big barbecue. Fine. Okay. I'll go. I don't think he realized the extent to which Avshalom has plotted and planned this event for the last 2 years. In part because I don't think he's bothered by his own conduct. I don't think he feels pangs of guilt in this story. Right? He thinks he got away with it. Nobody seems to have said boo. Dovid certainly didn't say boo. And so there's nothing to be afraid of because he doesn't remember the story. Well, he remembers what he did, but I don't think he remembers the evil that he had created and that was now simmering in the other half of the palace.
Even David didn't chastise him.
Oh, and that brings us to David. Like, even David didn't have, in this particular instance, David also lets down his guard because he's not suspicious of Avshalom. Now, it could be that he's a little more suspicious, which is why he doesn't want to go. Right? If he had no suspicions, maybe he wasn't going to be so quick to turn down Avshalom. Maybe on the other hand, after he, and this is where Avshalom's brilliance comes in, right? He's already refused to go himself. He's already turned down the invitation himself. He can't really turn down the invitation a second time. And the Avshalom's brilliance, and that's the Barbanel's piece earlier that we talked about, that we looked at, that Avshalom's brilliance was to start with the request that the king join us, knowing that the king's going to say no. And now he's put David in the corner because David can't say no a second time.
Maybe David isn't so fond of Amnon since Amnon's kind of a jerk.
Wait.
So maybe
how
he doesn't.
David feels about Amnon, we'll see at the end of the paragraph. I disagree with that assessment, but I'll show you at the end of the paragraph.
Okay.
But he certainly doesn't feel that he can refuse a second time. And that's where you see the sign of the chokhmah, if you will, of Avshalom. And Avshalom was sat there and planned this all out. At the end of the day, between Amnon, David, and Avshalom, if you had to take a step back before we know what's going on, before we know what's happening down the, Avshalom who kills Amnon and then goes to exile, and the rebellion and all of that. But just in terms of this event of this perek, who's the one individual acting out of a sense of morality and being driven by a sense of justice and leadership? It's Avshalom. David is certainly not. Amnon is the perpetrator. He's the criminal. And so Avshalom stands up and somebody has to sort out the sense of Mishpat V'Tzedek in this kingdom. And if David's not going to do it, I will. And so that brings us to, and here I'm going to go back to the screen share, I apologize. That brings us to the murder. And the last piece of the story. Yeah.
Do we know how old Avshalom is at this time? That he is so righteous about the justice and the tzedek and the mishpat and all that?
I mean, they're adults in the sense that they're not children.
Okay. Well, that's what I'm wondering. Are they still teenagers? Are they 20s, 30s?
No, I mean, they're teenagers. I mean, considering what we're dealing with, it's hard to know how old they are. Because the chronology here is very... remember, David is in Hebron for 6 years, and he has these children when he's in Hebron. Now he's in Yerushalayim for 33 years. So how old can they be? Right? That he dies 33 years later, meaning this is all happening in the period of within that time of the years that he's in Yerushalayim. So I can imagine early 20s, maybe? I can't put a number to it offhand. I can probably research it and see if that, but certainly not much older and certainly not much younger. All right, which brings us to the murder. Back to Pasuk of Chet. Eitzav Avshalom et narav lemor, re'una ketov lev amnon bayayin, v'marti alechem aku et amnon, v'amitem oto al tirau, alo ki enochi tziviti etchem chizku, v'yu b'nei chayel. Avshalom tells his servants how to perpetrate the whole thing. We're going to get him drunk, going to take him out. Don't be afraid. I'm giving you this command. This is coming from me. And so they do. Doesn't actually describe what happened. It just tells us that they did what Avshalom instructed them to do. Vayakumu kol bnei ha-melech. So all of the king's children climbed on their mules and fled.
That's crazy.
Now, why they fled, we're going to talk about, and why they're fleeing on a pered or a mule, we'll talk about. Both very powerful images. Okay? But let's first run through the rest of the story. So now they fled. Where did they flee? Where did they flee to? And why did they flee? Two very powerful questions. It doesn't say where they fled to. Why they fled is not a hard guess. Right? Why did they...
And they didn't know if they were next.
They thought Avshalom had lost his mind.
Remember, nobody knows why Avshalom killed Amnon. From the perspective of the rest of the Bnei HaMelech, what is Avshalom doing if not starting a rebellion for the throne of David? Like, they don't know that he's taking revenge for something that happened 2 years ago. Nobody remembers what happened 2 years ago. Even in today's world with internet newspapers, people don't remember what happened 2 years ago. So in their minds, Avshalom has just killed the crown prince. Who's next in line? Whoever next in line in the line to the throne is. So they run. They flee. I doubt that they're fleeing to Yerushalayim. Why? Why would I doubt that they fled towards Yerushalayim?
Maybe they thought Avshalom was heading there.
If he's after the entire royal families that he lays claim to the throne, who's next in line?
David.
So the last place they want to go is back to Yerushalayim. Okay, let's just read a couple of psukim and then we'll come back to this whole story. They are running. in the way. They haven't returned home. V'ashmua ba'al David lemor, hika avshalom et kol b'nei ha'melech, v'lo natar mehem echad. And the rumor comes back to the palace that Avshalom has executed the entire royal family. Because he killed Amnon and then everybody fled. So the assumption is that he ran after them. And though whoever got back to the palace reported that Avshalom is on a bloodbath and he's killed everybody. The rest of the royal family didn't return home. So the assumption is he's killed them all. Vayakom ha-melech meikrat begadav, vayishkav arza, v'chol avadav nitzavim, kri begadim, the king arose, he tore his garments, he put on the saddle of earth, his servants stood by with their torn clothes, and they don't know what's going on. The lack of knowledge, the ambiguity, the sense of what's going on, the turmoil created by this one murder has now created absolute anarchy. Nobody knows what's going on. The question is, the two questions, why is the suspicion that Avshalom is now after everybody, partially because he's invited everybody, right? He invited the entire Avshalom, he invited Amnon and all the Bnei HaMelech. He's killed Amnon, who's next in line to the throne. Assumption is he's going to take out everybody or everybody who stands between him and the throne. Well, who stands between him and the throne? It depends on who he is, right? It depends on who he is. Assuming for a moment that he's the son of a Pelegesh, I don't think he has a claim to the throne. The last time we encountered somebody who did not have a claim to the throne because he was the son of a Pelegesh, but who had a very large royal family who stood between him and the throne, but he wanted the throne, so he killed everybody to get it, was... Okay, we're testing how far back you remember. Shoftim. Anybody remember learning Shoftim once upon a time? All right. Story of Gidon. Story of Gidon, and I put this on the source page as well. You have it here at the top of source 7. I'm going to read it out of Mikro Gedolot. Gidon was a very powerful shofet. We're talking several hundred years earlier in sequence. Gidon, and the last piece of the story was that they wanted to make Gidon king. And they'd even asked him to be king, and he refused. He turned them down. I'm going to go back a few psukim. I'm not going to rule over you. My son is not going to rule over you. God rules over you. You don't need a king. But they had asked, they had wanted, he was so powerful, the victory was so powerful that they said to him, Mishobanu gamata gamincha gambemicha, was time to establish a throne. So he refused. But on the other hand, Ilugidon ayu shivim bani, he had 70 sons. Why did he have 70 sons? He had many wives. Now, many wives is not a biblical phenomenon. Biblical phenomenon, you can have polygamy. Biblically, most people had one wife. Maybe sometimes they had two if they had trouble having children. Who had many wives? Nashim Rabot?
Sure.
Kings. Kings typically had many wives because wives were part of what we would call a political region. But they also, therefore, had the Pelegesh concubines. So Gidon had many wives and therefore 70 children. Upilagsho, and he also had a Pelegesh. He had a Pelegesh in Shechem. And she also gave birth to a child. That child's name was Avimelech. Now, Avimelech is a very ironic name for the son of a Pelegesh. Because the term means my father is king. And Gidon dies, and that's the end of that story, and that's fine. And then we're going to jump to the next parak. Beginning of parak 10. Vayelech Avimelech ben Yerubal Shechema el Achei Imo. Vayedaber alehem et kol mishpachat bet avi limo. Avimelech comes to Shechem. His mother is a Pelegesh from Shechem. comes to his family in Shechem and tells them the following. Dabruna b'lozne kol balei Shechem. Ma tov lechem. Which would you prefer, people of Shechem? Hamshal b'chem shivim ish kol b'nei Yerubal. Would you prefer to be led by the 70 sons of Gidon? Or imashal b'chem ish echad? Or would you rather one person rule over you? Let me tell you. Dictatorships are a lot simpler. They're a lot simpler. Government is much simpler when you have a dictatorship.
Is it Abimelech or Achimelech?
Abimelech. And not only that, uzchartem ki atzmechem uvsachem ani. And remember, before you answer this question, that I am your flesh and blood. The sons of Gidon are foreigners. I am from Shechem. וידברו אחרי אמו עליו באוזני כל בעלי שכם את כל הדברים האלה ויית ליבם אחרי אבימלך יאמרו אחינו. The people of Shechem were swayed to Abimelech because he said he is their brother. So they gave him 70 coins of silver, and with those 70 coins of silver, he hired himself an army, אנשים ריקים ופוחזים, ויזכור בהם אבימלך אנשים ריקים ופוחזים. He hired worthless, reckless army people to follow him. And what does he do with them? Vayavo Beit Aviv Ofrata, he comes to his father's house in Ofra, which is not far from Beit Chatzor, by the way.
Efrat.
Not Efrat, Ofra.
Yeah.
Vayaharog et Echav b'nei Yerubal shivim ish al evan echat. And he takes out the entire royal family, all 70 of them slaughtered in one fell swoop, except for one small child who survives, Yerubal, Yotam, and that's the rest, a different part of the story. But he's the son of a Pilagish. His claim to the throne is 71 people down the line. You'll forgive me for the reference, but you remember the story of the villain in Frozen? Right? And he was 12th in line. Okay, he's 71 people down the line, and he's the son of a Pilagish. He has no claim to the throne until he takes out everybody else. And what ensues is a great civil war. What did Absalom just do? He took out Amnon, the royal prince, and considering the fact that he's the son of Ma'acha, daughter of a king, he thinks he himself is legitimately claimed to the throne. On the other hand, everybody else thinks he's the son of a Pilagash, which means that everybody else would put somebody, one of the Bnei Melech before him. So to get to the royal family, to get to the throne, he's got a long list of people he's got to get through. It starts with Amnon, and it ends with all the rest of the Bnei HaMelech, including David. And the chaos that ensues after he takes out Amnon is extraordinary. And by the way, that's not the only biblical story of that ilk. You have the story of Ataliah, who kills all of the royal family of the house of David because she wants to claim the throne. And there are one or two other stories like it. I'm going to not get into too much of that because I don't need to. But nonetheless, you understand that this is all chaos. Because why doesn't anybody stop and say, wait a second, this is not chaos. This is not Avshalom looking to destroy the royal family and take claim to the throne. This is Avshalom exacting revenge and an act of vengeance for his sister's shame and his sister's honor that was shamed by Amnon. This is a personal act of vengeance. In a personal act of vengeance, the only one who's in danger is Amnon, nobody else. But that's how it happens. The rest of the family, they jumped on their pereds, on their mules, and they ran. They didn't even have a time to sit and have a conversation with Avshalom, because in their minds, it's pure chaos, in pandemonium. In their minds, Avshalom has started a rebellion against the king. Not stopping. Again, how many people remember that the story of Amnon and Tamar? How many people know that Avshalom is now acting on behalf of his sister's shame in order to... People just don't have that frame of reference. The only frame of reference here is that the son of Ma'acha just killed the crown prince.
Except for one person who kind of set it up.
Oh, we're going to come to him in a second. We're going to come to him in a second. Hold on that thought for a second. Yonadav will come back to us at the end of the parak. But before we get to Yonadav, one interesting piece of information, and that is the fact that it's a very ironic image. They all jump on their vehicles of flight. And what is the vehicle of flight?
Mules.
A mule. It's just like a mule compared to a horse is like it's nothing. So why are they all jumping on a parrot? So this is just factual. This is not the interpretation. We just need to know the facts. And the facts are that in that period of time, and for how long it stays that way, it's unclear. But certainly in that arena, royalty rode on mules. Soldiers rode on horses. Unlike in Egypt, where the kings rode on horses, and unlike in Babylon and in Persia and in Assyria and in other regions where the kings rode on horses. In the world of Malchei Yisrael, the kings, the royal family, rode on mules. And I'll show you some very interesting precedents. For example, here, and I'll just give you a couple of examples in the text, in the source page. This is Shmuel Bet Perek Yurchet. This is Avshalom. Remember, when Avshalom, this is a very famous story, Avshalom, how Avshalom gets caught in the civil war with David in Yar Ephraim in the forest. He gets caught because he has very long hair. And his hair gets caught by a tree. So the pasuk says, "Vayikare Avshalom lifnei avdei David, v'Avshalom rochev al hapered." Avshalom was riding on his mule. "Vayavah pered tachat shover cha'ila," and the pered, the mule, ran under the branch of a tree, of a big tree, and the branch caught him. "Vayechazak rosho be'ila," caught his head, caught his hair, and "Vayitan ben shemayim uven haaretz v'pered asher tachtav avar," and he literally, the pered kept running. And Avshalom was caught by his head, by his hair, and he was literally hanging in the air. But he's riding a parrot. He's riding a mule. Or David commands in Perek Aleph of Sefer Melachim, as the whole conflict with the Doniyahu emerges, and David has to set the record, who's going to be the heir to the throne? And that heir is going to be Shlomo. So David commands, "V'yomer ha-melechlem, k'chui mechemet avdei adonechem, mirkatem et Shlomo b'ni al ha-pirda asher li." Go and ride Shlomo on my mule. It's a hard concept for us to get around because we're so used to royalty riding on horses.
But isn't the terrain better? Isn't it an issue of that? Aren't mules better on that land?
Maybe, but the soldiers certainly rode on horses.
Yeah.
Soldiers certainly rode on horses. And but the kings rode, even in battle, Avshalom is in the middle of battle. His animal was a parrot. Now, a parrot is much slower than a horse, which would explain why the message gets back to the palace before the rest of the family comes back.
Oh,
to
right.
The soldiers return to the palace, they're riding on horses. The royal family, the Bnei HaMelech, they're on, number one, they're on parrots, and number two, they're all fleeing off into the mountain.
Isn't there a rule that you shouldn't have too many horses and wives?
Yes, for kings.
Oh.
That is true. The limit is set by David, but maybe it should have been said earlier, but different conversation, but yes.
Maybe they got away with it by having mules.
In the meantime, so this is what's going on, right? So there's the pandemonium. Nobody knows what's going on. Nobody knows what Avshalom has done. Or he's taken out of Amnon, and the royal family has disappeared. Disappeared. They don't know where they are. If you're thinking about it from the perspective of David in the palace, the soldiers coming back from battle, but the soldiers are coming back from Baal Chatzor. They're not coming back with Amnon, and they're not coming back with Avshalom. We'll see why in a moment. And they're not coming back with any of the Bnei HaMelech. Where's the rest of the family? And a bunch of soldiers coming back on their own. All they know is Avshalom has taken out the entire royal family. This is the beginning of a rebellion. This is the beginning of an all-out treasonous assault. Yaakov HaMelech v'ikrat begadav v'ishkav ha'etza v'chol avadav nitzavim nikru'e begadim. Everybody's on the ground crying, tearing their garments. This is a kingdom on the brink of collapse.
Rabbi, if Avshalom's, it was his servant that killed them, how did they know it when they knew it, that it must have been from Avshalom? Like in that split second when they're all fleeing, they realized that it was Avshalom?
I don't think it's quite as hidden as that. I think Avshalom doesn't get his hands dirty, but he's not claiming that he's not in charge. You know, he's probably standing over them and saying, okay, now. And they go and they smite and they cut his head off or whatever they do with the sword. And everybody looks and stands, sees Avshalom commanding his servants to kill Amnon, and they run. That's the kind of the... Avshalom's not hiding it, on the contrary. All right. Which brings us to the end of the story. Vayan Yonadav ben Shim'a Achi David. Yonadav returns to the conversation. We haven't encountered him again since his fateful words of advice to Amnon in the first place, which was to figure out a way to bring Tamar to him, or to figure out a way to bypass Avshalom have a conversation with David directly, depending on the two interpretations that we offered to the first half of the parak. But he's described as Ish Chacham Ma'od, wise. He, we'll see in a moment, he himself feels the pain of what Amnon had done to Tamar and had done to Avshalom. V'yayin Yonadav ben Shimi Achi David v'yomer, Al yomar Adoni, Et kol ha'narim b'nei ha'melachim yitu. No, my king, do not think that Avshalom has killed all of the royal family. That is not so. Ki Amnon levadom met. Only Amnon has died here. Ki api Avshalom haitasumam yom anato tamarachoto. For this has been Avshalom's intention from the day that Amnon raped his sister. This is Yonadav reporting to David and saying, you're misreading the facts. Avshalom killed Amnon not as an act of rebellion and treason. Avshalom killed Amnon as an act of vengeance and honor for his shamed sister from 2 years ago. Something which he doesn't say, but we would imply, something David should have taken care of himself. No, my king, don't take to heart, don't think for a second that all of the king's sons have been killed. Amnon levado met, only Amnon is dead. And therefore, there's nothing to worry about. Because for all intents and purposes, from Yonadav's perspective, you'll forgive the editorial inserted comment, Amnon's not worth much. And essentially what Yonadav has done is he's kind of poured cold water on all of their angst and said, you're misreading the math. This is not treason. This is just Avshalom in an honor, an act of honor for his sister, killing the one who shamed and forced and raped his sister. Why is Yonadav the only one who realizes what, and he's not there. Yonadav's not there in Baal Chatzor, and Yonadav was not privy to Avshalom's intentions. So how does Yonadav read the map? Why is Yonadav the only one who understands correctly what transpired when everybody else is assuming that this is an act of open rebellion? It's possible that he knows Avshalom well, right? It's also possible that he is the only one in the story who still feels the same anger, shame, and betrayal that Avshalom feels. Because Amnon betrayed not only Tamar and Avshalom and David, Amnon also betrayed Yonadav. Yonadav was his confidant. Yonadav was his friend. Yonadav had suggested to him a mechanism by which he could re-engage with his love, which was Tamar, and with his father, who was David, and you know, that, and Amnon turned all of that into an act of lust and crime. So Amnon is guilty of betraying not only Tamar and Avshalom, but he's guilty of betraying the trust and friendship of Yonadab. Yonadab feels that anger. Yonadab is as hurt as anybody else. And so Yonadab reads the map and he says, this is not about rebellion. This is about Avshalom doing what I've been thinking about for the last 2 years, which is how do we find justice in all that has transpired? So that's his theory. That's his conjecture. It's not fact, right? He has no proof. He's just comforted David to suggest that this is in fact what's going on. And so what comes next is the proof to all that we are saying. And that starts in Pasuk Lamed Daled. Vayivrach Avshalom. First thing we're told, Avshalom runs. He runs. Where did he run to? We'll see in a moment. He fled. In the palace, the young man, watcher, the watchman, lifts up his eyes, and he sees a group of people coming back from the mountain, riding on animals of some sort off in the distance. He reports this to the palace. Yonadav says to the king, oh, Bnei HaMelech have come home. I told you the Bnei HaMelech would come back. The Bnei HaMelech indeed came back. And once they came back and reported that Avshalom had killed Amnon, now the whole depth of the story has come out. Avshalom's act of vengeance against Amnon. Avshalom kills Amnon. They begin to cry. They're crying, they're weeping bitterly. For what? For their son who was killed. Mm-hmm. For the brother who was killed.
Or maybe for themselves. I don't know. Like, if you said that they thought that they were going to be killed
this
next.
This is Vayitabel al bono kol hayamim. This is David mourning your son. This is for Amnon.
But I'm saying, what about all the other kings?
Hang on a second. We have Shalom Barach. Avshalom ran away. Vayelach, where did he go? El Talmai ben Amihud Malach Geshur. He goes to his grandpa. He goes to his mother's father, the king of Geshur. And David is left, Vayitabel al beno kol hayamim. David is left to mourn for his son all of his days. There's an interesting machloket of the Mefarshim where the kol hayamim means all of the 3 years that Avshalom is in exile, or does all of his days mean literally his whole life? It's machloket of the Mefarshim. But Vayitabel is referring to David, and the beno is referring to Amnon. That's fairly clear. David is mourning for his loss of his son. He's an avelus for his son who has been killed by the hands of Avshalom. Fratricide, regicide. Avshalom, Barach. Where did Avshalom go? Me'elach Geshur. Misham shalosh shanim. And then he went there for 3 years. But after 3 years, Vatichal David HaMelech letzet al Avshalom. This word, Vatichal David letzet, just grammatically is a complicated structure, because Vatichal is a verb conjugated in the feminine form. And David is not feminine. So the Mefarshim all suggest, and it's a very high likelihood of being shot, that Tichal David, if you look at the Targum, it says, Vachemedat Nafsha de David, that the Chal Nefesh David, the soul of David, and the Nefesh is Lashon Nekeva. The nefesh of David began to pine for Avshalom. After 3 years, after it's all done, after all the energy and the temperature has come down, and after the avelus for Amnon, Avshalom, David begins to pine for Avshalom. Ki nicham al Amnon, ki met. He was comforted for Amnon. Amnon was gone. Amnon had died. terrible tragedy. But now the one son he has left alive is Avshalom. And Avshalom is sitting out there in exile. And so beginning of Perek Yudalad, Vayeda Yoav ben Tzviya ki lev ha-melech al Avshalom, Yoav understood how much David was pining for Avshalom. And the rest of the Perek will be how to bring Avshalom back from exile. But that is the end of the story, where he finally finds some element of, finishes the Avelos. Okay, he's not going to bring back, as he said after the death of the child in Bathsheba, I'm going to eventually meet him after 120. He's not coming back to me. Shalom is alive, and David pines for him, and that's how the parak ends.
I have a question.
Is Tamar mentioned ever again?
Yeah, nobody cares about her.
I was just going there. Wasn't she living in Avshalom's house?
Yes, and what happens to her, we don't know. She's mentioned again in Divrei Hayamim in the Yichus of the royal family as Tamar Achotam, their sister, but we don't know what happens to her any more than we know what happens to Dina after the story of Shechem.
Right.
The story of Tanakh is the story of the royal family. So the families that have a role and a status in the royal lineage is relevant. Unfortunately, that's just, right? It's not history. It's a history of a royal family. So I've kind of put that in perspective.
So after Avshalom tells her to stay in his house, she's not mentioned again?
I don't believe that she has a role at that point forward any more than Dina does. Any more than
Bill or Zilpah. Make a right.
Any more than Bill or Zilpah do, right? Again, we tend to think of this from the perspective of history. It's not. It's the chronicle of a royal family. You have to define royal families by the malchus. That's just a fact. So
yeah, but she was the part of the initial
story. Okay, right. relevant to the story. She was the part of the story. Same way that Dina was. Much more than that, you're not going to find. All right. With this, we will conclude, except for one. I have to leave you with a cliffhanger, because we brought the story to a close almost, and that would not be fair, because I can't not leave you with a cliffhanger, number one. Number two, next week is our last class before we take a two-week break. So we have class next Monday, and then off for 2 weeks. So let me finish with the following observation. Here is the last psukim in the text, starting with Pasuk Lamed Dalet. Anybody see it? How many times does it tell me in these six psukim? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 5 or 6 psukim. How many times does it tell me that Avshalom fled?
3 or 4. 5, I don't know.
Good guesses, right?
I see 2 right away.
Let's count them out. Pasuk Lamed Dalet, Vayivrach Avshalom.
I see 3.
Right.
Lamed Zayin.
Avshalom fled. Pasuk Lamed Dalet. Then Pasuk Lamed Zayin, Avshalom barach vayelech al Tamai ben Amihud melech Geshur. Avshalom fled and he went to Tamai son of Amihud, king of Geshur. Then a pasuk later, Avshalom barach ve'elach Geshur ve'hisham shalosh shanim. Avshalom went to Geshur and he was there.
Sorry, for 3. I said 3. Okay.
3 references. I have 3 separate phrases in 3 separate psukim to tell me that Avshalom fled. Now, I could put all 3 of these references into one pasuk. Very easily. Vayivrach Avshalom ve'elach al Tamai ben Amihud melech Geshur ve'hisham shalosh shanim. Avshalom fled, and he went to Tamai Melech Geshur, and he was there for 3 years. Why break it up into 3 separate psukim?
Is that our homework?
Not only that, the 3 separate psukim are injected into the middle of stories where they don't belong. But that we have to work through the text, so I'll show you that B'ezrat Hashem in our class. What they literally interrupt the sequence of events that where they simply don't belong, and pieces of the story. We're kind of sprinkling pieces of the story of Avshalom's flight to Geshur in the middle of all kinds of other pieces of the story. So Zat Hashem, what we will do in our last class before the Hanukkah break, it's not going to be a class on Hanukkah. Otherwise, we will just I'll leave you hanging, so that's not good. We will address this question, Bezrat Hashem, next week, and then we'll take a break. We're going to clean break. We're going to leave the story of Amnon and Tamar and of Shalom, hopefully end up with a much more happy-go-lucky, bright story of Avshalom's rebellion against David and the civil war that ensues, because that's what's coming next.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Kola. Thank you, Rabbi.
As you enjoy.
Thank you, Rabbi.